Hello, this is Aiden with Oddball Pilot. I'm sitting with James and Daniel in Sirkat, Nepal, Western Nepal. And I'm over here working with a company called Goma Air. Ran into Daniel, he's over here doing the same thing. Interestingly enough, Daniel and I both worked for the same company in Africa at different times. That was fun to discover. And when we got to Sirkat, I saw a very strange aircraft, strange to me, on the ramp. And it turned out it was a Kiwi, a New Zealand airplane, and that's how I ended up meeting James, who's from New Zealand, and he's here flying as well. And we realized as we were just talking that we all had questions for each other. I'm interested in flying in New Zealand, and James is interested in Alaska. Daniel has a JAR license, which I've always been curious about how difficult it is to get. And he's also done some flying in Libya and a lot of flight instructing in, actually in Dallas, in Texas. We'll start with sort of our standard format. I'll be asking James some questions just about how he got into flying, and then we'll move on to there. We'll just move on to a general conversation.
Sure.
And we'll ask Daniel how he got into flying and get a little background, everybody's background. We know what my background is, so we'll dig into everyone else's. So James, let's start with you. You started flying in New Zealand.
Yes, I did. I was about 20, 21, I think. I had a little bit of money from some overseas work, and I've always wanted to fly.
Okay.
Yeah, and I had enough money to get my private license, and then got offered to apply for a loan, a student loan, to get my commercial, and I did. Regretted it, yeah.
What's the flight training like in New Zealand? Is it
When I learned to fly, it was good. It was a small aero club, okay. And this was just before the big boom for India, especially when pilots, cadets or young pilots would come through. And just after I left, I was in a class of about 8 to 10, all local guys, and then the next intake had about 40, I think.
Okay, so New Zealand, you're getting a lot of Indian pilots going to New Zealand.
Yes, we are, a lot.
Okay, that ties in with Daniel was doing training in Dallas, and a lot
Texas,
of Nepalese pilots.
Yes, where we had I would say after the unfortunate event of 2011, most of the flight schools were closed, so things that this Indian booming just brought all the flight school from the grave.
Yeah.
And at the time, 2004, 2006, they were actually 3,500 Indian students in the U.S.
Okay.
And one guy that is actually working in India was able to bring 30 students per month.
Okay.
In our flight school, so we were having this hyperbolic booming, and with lots of.
Yeah.
Capabilities and
right.
A lot of issues and training and
well, I've seen a lot of foreign training in the U.S. I know Japanese Airlines have trained there in Lufthansa. I wasn't aware there was that much going on in New Zealand.
Yeah, it's blown up
quite a bit.
A lot, yeah.
Okay, is it so? Flight training's a reasonable cost in New Zealand?
Yeah, I've heard. I don't actually know the cost and haven't researched everywhere else, but I was told it's one of the cheapest.
You started an aero club. And then did you flight instruct after that?
No.
Skydivers?
First I was volunteering at a glider tow club.
Okay.
So I was flying a Pawnee and part-time loader driving for a crop dusting firm.
Okay.
Because that's always been my ultimate goal.
Be a crop duster?
Yeah.
Cool.
Which there's plenty of it in New Zealand.
So when you... Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. I'm going to go next door up there and then New Zealand. Crop dusting might be... Yes.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, Australia, there's a lot, too.
1 hour, we won't have enough.
No. When you started flying, then your intentions were to fly crop dusters. You weren't thinking overseas so much.
Absolutely not. That was just the roll of the die.
Okay. Are there opportunities in New Zealand for airline jobs? Is there national airline in New Zealand that you fly for?
There is, yes, there's a national airline, and it's operated by 4 or 5 smaller companies.
Okay.
Generally speaking, I think you need to be a little bit more qualified than some other jobs around the world that I've heard.
Okay.
Like, for instance, some of the Indian airlines, they'll take 200-hour pilots sort of thing, bring them right through. But nowadays, it's sort of a minimum 1,000 hours, a couple hundred on multi-command, I think.
For the national airline.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's flying by jets.
No. Starts beach 1900s, okay. ATRs.
Just flying around the island.
Yeah. Okay. Just the domestic flights.
Would you say that's what most New Zealand pilots who start flying, is that what they're looking at? Or is crop dusting? And
I think most do want to go the regional and then international.
Okay.
But
that wasn't what you were interested in?
No. And I was from quite a small aero club group at the time, and we all had different things. We had one guy who was doing his fixed wing license just so he could get his instrument rating and then get that converted to his helicopter license.
Because
he was helicopter pilot through and through.
Right.
But it's cheaper to go through fixed wing
first.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a friend who's doing it in the US and he just went straight rotorcraft and oh man, it's expensive.
Yeah. Yeah, it was cheaper for him to, rather than do his instrument rating on the helicopter, to go through, get his private license on a fixed wing, and then do his instrument rating on the fixed wing, and then convert it back
right
to his helicopter.
Yep.
Which is quite cool.
Yeah.
Now
yeah.
He's got both licenses. Lucky bugger.
That's what, yeah, I always excited. I mean, we've talked, but you've seen me run around these Mi-17s and get all excited. I just
love
helicopters, but God, they're so expensive.
That's right.
And you're starting back at the bottom. You know, no matter how much fixed wing time you go, you recycle, it's a whole different world.
Yeah.
So you went from the Pawnees, glider towing, and then I know you flew skydivers.
That was further down the track.
Okay.
Next was, I was loader driving for a different company. And they had an aircraft called a Fat Man, which looks like a pony, but fatter. And, by chance, because I was going through the phases in New Zealand, it's not on your hours in the agricultural aviation side. It's done on doing the hard yards, you know, quite old school. First, you'll do 4 to 5 years driving a truck,
okay,
loading the aircraft.
Chemical.
Yeah. And if you prove yourself, then you'll get a seat. That's usually how it works. And I was just, you know, going through the phases and slowly building up. And I managed to get on the insurance list so I could ferry the aircraft for maintenance.
Okay.
And through that, one day I was in at one of the maintenance facilities, and I happened to speak to a guy who turned out to be the chief pilot of this company, Kiwi Air, and they do geophysical surveying.
Okay.
And, yeah, it was just blind luck. Met this guy I didn't know, and he was like, oh, well, come in for an interview tomorrow if you got nothing going. So I got up early the next day and took the 4 or 5 hour drive over to Gisborne, had an interview and walked away with a job.
And that was when you ended up in Africa then?
Yeah, through that, I ended up going to Africa. I didn't plan on it. I didn't actually know any countries there, or
yeah,
probably would have had trouble pointing out Africa as a continent. But yeah, I was there a month, and then got called into the office and said, I'm going to Tanzania next week.
Oh, wow.
And that was it.
Yeah, and off you went.
Yeah.
And that led to the job.
Yeah, more or less. Yeah. That sort of kicked everything off, because we're traveling all around.
Like once you're in that international circuit, you start hearing about things here and there.
That's right. You gain a lot more experience just flying somewhere new and learning something different, and then you can take that in and apply it back to back home or something like that.
Right.
I was there for a year, a bit over a year, I think. And then finished up in PNG on my last job, Papua New Guinea.
Okay.
And went back home. I left that job and got one in Queenstown.
Which is a normal job.
Yeah, that was a skydiving job.
Okay, that's always fun though.
Yeah, I love that job. Queenstown's a a wonderful place. Highly recommended.
So I'm going to dig into New Zealand flying a little bit. It's one of those places that I'd love to go fly. So first off, and for my own interest, as a foreigner going to fly in New Zealand, do you think that's an easy path, or do you think that's pretty difficult to do?
It's hard to say, because in some circles it's more who you know,
right,
rather than what you know. Some circles you could go there, meet a guy, have a beer with him, have a good laugh, and then
have a job. So work permit issues, that's an issue.
Yeah, I think it will be.
Okay.
Only because of the amount of pilots that are being trained up now.
Okay, so there's certainly no pilot shortage.
That's right. It's more the, like what we're doing here, the unique or different new aircraft coming in.
Right.
Needing someone to train them up, something like that.
Okay. Ah, well, that's not... that's kind of sad.
Not what you were hoping.
Well, it's about what I expected. I thought it'd be... you know, a lot of countries, if there are enough pilots there, they don't need pilots, so why would they issue a work permit when they can have their own nationals doing it?
Yeah.
And I think Nepal's actually that way.
Yeah.
Like, we're all here because there weren't pilots currently qualified to fly the planes that we're flying.
That's right.
And, like, Daniel and I are working ourselves out of a job, deliberately. That's our job.
Yeah.
Get these guys up to speed in the caravan.
So, yous actually... didn't know each other before.
No, even though it's very common, I would say, in this industry that you've been there before. You've been there, done that. You know, it's
a small world.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Where you expect somehow to hear about this guy, and I would say, like, nowadays, I won't be surprised if 10 years from now, someone that we train kids from there, I met this guy once in Nepal, actually, a guy who left the place where I used to be in Fort Worth. I saw his picture on one of the movies at the...
Even more so, just walking around Kathmandu, you had at least 3 or 4 pilots come up that you had trained in Texas.
Absolutely, yeah.
which was nice.
You can expect after, like, probably 6 years of teaching or something like that, where you can expect to see those guys around the world, and that's the way I end up in South of America as well, with all the good friends and Africa, people out there, even in Congo.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way it works. It's more who knows and what you know.
All about kind of making connections.
Yes, absolutely.
Like good recipe. And
all that. So, back to New Zealand. What kind of flying jobs are there? You've got the regional carrier, which is flying 1900s. Do they have jets?
73s.
So you can move 320s. Up in there.
Yeah, and then that's more advanced. Like I'd
take a few years.
Yeah, I think they're asking 3,000 minimum, with 1,000 on in command on turboprops. Because like we were saying before, it's you've got all these pilots.
Yeah.
So you can.
It's an employer's market right now.
Yeah.
Not the other way around.
Exactly.
What other stuff is there to do? Like, you have float flying jobs. Helicopters are big in New Zealand.
They are. Yeah.
Like, what other jobs would a pilot get in New Zealand besides coming to Nepal?
Instructing is what most the route most people will take.
Okay. Build time there.
Yeah, and then sort of progress on to the scenic and charters, but I think scenic flying is one of the big ones.
Okay.
Scenic skydiving, you can get onto skydive flying with relatively low hours, I believe.
Yeah, I think, I mean, in the US it's that way.
Yeah.
That was my first, like, paying flying job, was flying skydivers.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't know what I was doing.
The volunteering, like I did for glider towing, that was easy to get into, but when you don't have a lot of money, it's difficult to get your rating, which I had to pay for myself.
So you had to get a rating in the potty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is good fun, because there's only one seat, so you You're by yourself right from the get-go.
I was talking to that crop duster I picked up in Spain. I was talking to the chief pilot. The way they do their annual training is the man from the Spanish authorities would just watch them from the ground. He'd stand there and watch. They'd go fly circles, do steep turns. He'd say, "Oh, it looks good. Glad you're done." Was it a similar sort of thing, or?
Yeah, it was.
A lot of ground time, and then.
Yeah, just got shot on the plane, you know.
Yeah.
It's a stick. Here's the throttle.
Figured out.
Yeah, and then obviously needed a bit of time and a tail wheel first.
Right.
Just so you knew what you were doing.
What plane did you use to get that time in?
Cup.
Cup. Okay. J3 or Super Cub?
Super Cub.
Yes, that is a good plane.
Yeah, had a lot of fun flying that one.
What are the planes, what planes do they fly in New Zealand for the scenics? And are they standard, like US type planes?
Yeah, or? 182s, 206s, 207s.
Okay, a lot of Cessnas.
Yeah, there's a small market for hunting.
Okay.
Which, where they'd go into the... Maybe from your perspective, slightly more interesting strips.
Right, yep.
I think you call it off airport.
We call it, they're actually, that's a gray area. As I consider it, if it's actually a strip that people go to on a regular basis, I don't consider it off airport.
Okay.
It's a rough strip. That's me personally.
So off airport is just like a paddock that's.
Yeah. Off airport, in my mind, you're landing on skis at a non established spot where you're landing on big tires on a gravel bar that people don't go to.
Okay.
Once planes go there on a regular basis, in my mind, I don't consider it off airport.
Yeah. Okay. Well, they wouldn't be considered off airport.
There's established strips, but short and rough.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's where most of the hunters will fly them, get flown in the middle of nowhere, and
right,
find a deer or two, and then come back at the designated time.
Is that in Cubs?
No, it's in mostly 180s, 185s.
Okay. Oh yeah, that's just like Alaska.
Yeah.
Those are great planes.
Yeah, they're the. A couple have a 206. It's a couple
those
of them
work well
around.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A company I used to work for used a 180 quite a bit, and then they switched to 206 and just put big tires on it, and it worked 95% as well.
Yeah.
Not as much fun though. How do the strips here in Nepal compare to what you were flying in New Zealand? Higher altitude.
Yeah, they're mostly the same. Generally, for our agricultural flying, the strips are similar, maybe shorter.
Okay. And they're just usually, from what I've seen with the ag flying, they'll just make a strip close to the fields you're going to be working on. Sometimes
yeah.
It's a road, and you drive the trucks out if you're the truck driver and bring the chemicals out.
That's right.
It just might work for a day out of some remote site. See, those could be considered off airport, I would think, if you're landing on a road.
Or yeah, I would think so too. Most of them. Well, some of them are just paddocks,
right?
Like you got to chase the sheep off,
yeah,
sort of thing.
A lot of sheep in New Zealand.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a few. What would be your advice to either let's start with just a New Zealand pilot, someone from New Zealand who wants to start flying, and they might want to end up at the airlines. What would be your advice on how to get into it in New Zealand, how to start flying in New Zealand?
For people coming to New Zealand.
For somebody in New Zealand, like if you're from Christchurch or Wanaka and you want to start flying,
one of the best ways to get out there and go and meet people.
Okay,
that's what I did. I spent maybe a month just going from company to company and throwing a very poorly written CV at them.
Yeah. So you're finding, and this is I see this for so many jobs. It really is FaceTime.
Yeah.
They really need to know who you are.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's how I got all the jobs I've got, actually.
And I'm guessing as a foreigner, if I wanted to go there, I could try it through the internet, but really the best way to do it is actually to show up.
Yeah, yeah. It's... You lose a lot of points if you just...
Call and say, I want a job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you're actually there, you're taking most of the effort just to get there in the first place, and that's recognized in New Zealand.
Yeah.
That's where the old school sort of mentality comes in.
Right.
Yeah.
Before we move on to Daniel, one more question. What after Nepal, do you have any plans, or do you plan to stay here for a long time? Still thinking about it.
no plans really, I'm just going with the flow. Something else comes up, then cool. If not, I'm happy.
Cool, but you're not really looking at the airlines or the...
No, absolutely not. I've never wanted to, never had that sort of desire.
Don't want the white shirt. Huh?
No, I'm happy flying.
I got another question. How's the lifestyle? I mean, do you like this lifestyle? I mean, you're moving a lot. It's fairly unsettled. Or is it rough on...
Not so much. I prefer just staying somewhere and, you know...
Right.
Just building something to live with.
Right. Well, you've been here a year and a half.
Yeah.
Which is a fair amount of time.
Yeah, and I've started doing that here, so I'm comfortable here. I can go home after work and have plenty to do.
Yeah, it's then you hang out at the orphanage. And,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's cool.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. Let's dig into Daniel a little bit, and then we'll start going in circles and getting, you know, little bits from everyone. So, Daniel, you started flying a little bit older, when you were a little bit later in life.
Yes,
is that
would be, even though the first flight I did was on a glider, I was like 18 years old.
Okay.
I used to glide in where you would be soon, in the Alps, Gap.
Oh yeah.
GAP is like one of the most famous spots to fly gliders out there. They've got this yearly competition out there. It's a very nice place, and a friend of mine told me, hey, why don't you come over for a week and see what it is, and
you tried it out.
Yes, it's just kind of very nice, very fun.
And so you enjoyed that, but then you didn't continue to pursue it.
Yeah, I was more interested with technology, high-tech, computers, electronics, so that's why
right.
I ended up in this kind of a place, but always interested in flying. I think it's in Europe, or at least in France, it's very expensive. You've got to pay for everything, so either you join a flight school. One of the most famous ones is ENAC, École Nationale de l'Aviation Civile, where I would say Air France used to pick up all the guys from, because you have to have a very solid knowledge about aviation, which is like somehow a little bit different from the FAA versus. But or you can join any other flight school. But the best way, if you want to start flying, is like in New Zealand, get to an aero club, and getting a little bit cheap. Most of the time, the instructor is freelance, so he's here because he likes to fly.
Right.
So it's just going to give you all the tips, all the tools, recommendation, and you feel comfortable in the plane. Then after, I would say you won't find airport everywhere, so you have to have a transportation. You
right.
cannot get your bicycle, and I was at that time in the Paris area, so Paris, it's a huge class airspace, which means from the bottom up to flight level 600,
yeah,
it's
yep.
like there's like no way you can,
unless
you, it's the 14th of July, and then you fly this formation, the most famous formation flight. But other than that, you go out there, you rent the plane, so it's like fairly cheap. And even though you end up with two or three airplanes going to the same place, you go on the picnic. So
right.
on the day, and you get your lunch on the airport.
It's just a way to build time.
Yes, absolutely. And I would say it took me like, 2 years to do this private certificate, because I was doing this near Paris on the grass field,
right? Yeah,
on the tailwheel, so on the mud, or like I would say the airport was closed like four.
Part time though, was it? Or
yes, I was working on the side, so you just do that during the weekend, or if the weather is appropriate, that just take like 1 or 2 hours.
You were running your own computer company.
Yes, I was. I think that was the privilege of it. I had the facilities just to take 1 or 2 hours during lunch and say, oh, call the guys, make sure that nothing is going on, so go out there, just fly 1 or 2 hours, come back, fly late in the evening because we could do so as well, which was very easy. But this, well, Paris is known because it's like well known because the weather is not so good, so it's raining a lot out there. So if you stop in a grass field, it's going to be muddy, and you don't want, it's like a golf course,
right?
You don't want to damage the place, so
yeah.
you just shut it down and you just wait for.
So you finished your private then on the grass strip, running your airline, you're running your
yes,
company, same time.
Yes.
Once you finished your private, you went on and did your commercial in France as well?
Yes, after like 10 years in this owning this company, I decided to make a 90 degrees angle in the career. And I said, at that time, it was possible to go in US. The first reason was it was cheap.
Right.
Cheaper. So, and you've got to choose either you go and you have to go in a place where they speak English.
Right.
Because English is the aviation language. It's like, and that's probably why I didn't go to Canada. But I should have dig a little bit deeper.
Oh, say, maybe, where they
yeah, Quebec, yeah. Maybe they speak a little bit French. I'm like, yeah, let's go in US.
And this was to work on your commercial rating.
Yes, on commercial
right.
rating. So
private you got in France.
Yes, absolutely. Where you get your either, well, the training was made the same way. You got your, the privilege of the hours that you bring with you, plus your pilot license, and you continue on your commercial instrument, and you get your 250
right.
hours.
Yeah.
At that time, it was possible to be able to work out there. So, by the
US.
Yeah, in the US. So either you've been sponsored by a company, or they go through a hiring process. And I don't know who paid for either you or the student or the
or
guy
the
who the company works, but thinks that you cannot move to another company.
Right.
You know?
You're with that company.
That company, you're married with those guys. It's
so
like,
so if I was coming from a different kind of company to work in the US, I need to go through the INS process and then get the visa.
This visa, but you cannot do it yourself. You cannot
right.
apply
you
by yourself.
You have to be sponsored
yes,
by a company.
Yes, the company has to do it for you.
Okay. So you need a job before you can get the visa.
Yes, absolutely. You have to do so this way, and it's even worse now since the September 11 because you've got to get rid of all those American pilots there on the ground, and I think there's so many.
A lot of American pilots.
And,
sounds like New Zealand's that way too.
Yeah. Even though those airfare where they say or air job fair where you see the line of pilots that.
Right.
For me, it's a waste of time. Those guys, they've got the dress, like everything is set up, they've got hours on jet experience. I'm not going to even knock on the door of those
right.
people.
That's looking for the more of the commuter
yes.
and the airline jobs.
And another way you can get a work, you know, I would say it doesn't have to be for the aviation industry, but you get married.
Yes. Yep.
Okay, you love your wife so much that...
But you're dating a French woman.
Yes, but she's American, yes.
Okay.
And or you have... The last one is like the American government is having this kind of a green card lottery
yep.
every year round. So either you apply yourself, it's possible, you go to the INS.gov, I think it is, and it's free. And depending on where you're from, they will issue, like for France, for instance, might be 500 green card a
right.
year, or India might be not.
You're saying, so what you're saying is that different countries get different number of visa or green cards
yes.
that will be issued.
So let's put it
in
this
the lottery
way.
System.
Let's say that every year the US government says, okay, we're going to put like 5,000 green cards on the market.
Right.
And depending on the country, we might say, okay, 500 for France, 10 for New Zealand, for instance, 0 for, I don't know, you name them, or
Ukraine.
Canada, Ukraine.
Why not?
Libya. Yes.
There we go. I don't think
yeah.
Flight schools within the universities there.
Yes,
they do. There are a few very well known ones like University of North Dakota and Embry-Riddle,
yeah.
which are 4-year universities. But there are a lot of community colleges, 2-year colleges, that'll have an aviation program.
Okay.
And then there are other four-year ones I don't know of off the top of my head.
You have to maintain your, how do we say that, your student...
status.
Status, thank you so much. And you have to, there's a lot of trick, but you have to watch maybe regarding the weather, because most of the time you cannot fly if the weather's not too good, so you have to find a place where the weather will make you fly and get your training done very quickly, because things are changing so fast, and you have to pay attention to the price. Amber Reader might be the, I would say the most renowned, like ENAC in French, like Cabair, or...
We're jumping around a little bit now.
But it's very expensive.
Yeah, so the what we're saying is that the four-year programs are very, Emory Riddle is probably, I don't know, $40,000 a year or something.
Yeah.
And I totally made up that number, but Emory Riddle and the University of North Dakota are pretty expensive.
Okay.
The community colleges are going to be fairly inexpensive. As soon as you're in the aviation program, the price is going to go up because you throw in the flight time.
Yeah.
So you're adding the cost of university plus the cost of the flying lessons.
But I was thinking more along the lines of that's going, a way in.
Yeah, get a four-year degree.
Yeah.
It actually, it. My guess is that you're right, that if you go to a school, you have the visa, you start making those connections.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you leave the school, you know somebody at this company, and they're willing to sponsor you for the through the INS procedure to get the visa. That would be my guess. I'm going to look into this a bit when I get back home, because I think there's all this information online.
Okay.
But probably takes some digging to get to it. And I've told you I've known some Russian and some Norwegian pilots and some German pilots who flew in Alaska. And most of the companies that I know in Alaska aren't going to bother sponsoring someone. See, they're enough American pilots, they don't have to.
Yeah.
And so there's a way they got these jobs. I don't know. I might just call them up and ask some of them what they did to get their jobs. And seems to me there might be some other backdoor ways. I don't, you know, they're legal, that are, you know, correct. You'd have a very hard time flying for an airline under the table.
Yeah. I could imagine.
Yeah, they're both, especially with schedules, they do a background check. They look in their past 7 years of work history. They're an FAA. I've got this for exactly. There's a, they look in your work history.
Interested, and at the same way I say, well, I still want to be a pilot, so I'm going to try to find a job still in the aviation industry. So that's why I became like a load master. I would say load master, I think, is the most appropriate transition. Otherwise we say agent trafic in French, or you take care about the plane wasn't on the ground, so you do the load sheet,
right.
You manage all the team around, so the plane, the guy who loads the bags, the guy who was cleaning,
right.
The,
did you get that job in the UK then?
No, he was in Europe, in France,
okay.
In Lyon. And I said at that time, what can I do? I'm like, I'm not going to give up on this. So I decided just to get my JA license.
Right.
But I couldn't stop working again. So what I decided to do is just to do it on the distance learning.
Oh, okay.
And instead of doing, something like that. And instead of doing this in France, once again, saying English, aviation industry has to be, I decided to do it in UK.
Right.
To raise the challenge for me. And I joined, I would say, a university named as Cranfield, or went to Cranfield Airport, and decided to do it this way. So I would say fairly the process is the same everywhere in Europe. It's like you buy the books,
yep.
1,900 British pound.
Yep, which is going to be roughly 3,000 US dollars.
Yes, you've got 14 subjects to cover. So
right.
It's like, instead of having one book, you've got... You expand it with more details.
Right, yeah.
Do I know better?
It just, so briefly, how long did it take to get to convert your U.S. license to a JAR?
I would say at first, I see many websites and many people, unfortunately, they say convert, which is absolutely wrong.
Right, you're getting a new license.
Yes, you get a new license.
But you do get some credit.
Exactly, credit would be better. You adapt what you've got, and you bring it to, let's per se, you need a total time 250 hours to get everything done commercial. What they're saying is, no matter what you've got, 5,000 hours, okay, they will take credit of or death. But in order to get your single commercial license, you need to have at least 5 hours on a single complex airplane.
Right.
And to get your instrument, multi-engine, you need 15 hours. Okay? And that's, you take for granted all the previous experience. So as long as you're good, and it took me like, I did everything in 22 hours.
Okay. But,
so.
In flight time.
In flight time versus right. flight time. But yeah. still you have to do the process of the 14 returns.
Right. Yep.
The trick is, the 14 written, it's like you can do it in 6 months, or you've got the maximum duration of 18 months. Just to make, I'm going to try to make it very short because it's kind of difficult to understand. You've got the same subject, like let's pursue airflow, aerodynamics, cockpit management,
right, you've got a lot of
human factors, and they are all organized the first week of the month. So, and they are the same order, Monday morning, Monday afternoon, Tuesday morning, afternoon, and depending the flight school you work with, they will organize a set of.
So in order.
Yes.
You have to take the exam at a certain time. You've got a set number of months to do all the exams.
Yes.
18 months.
Yes, in 18 months.
And then you, so you have to study and take these exams and get them done within 18 months, or you start the process over.
Yes, and there's
the exams are held on certain days of the week.
Yes.
Times of the month.
Exactly, and the trick is once again. If you're smart, you can do 14 tests in 1 week.
Okay, right, you've done the studying, right.
Yeah, you're like, it's boiling out there, you're ready to do everything. But most of the time, they take you like four sitting and say that, well, we're going to study this, like, let's proceed in January, you're going to get those four subjects in, like, so January, February,
like, yeah,
and March.
Need a lot of details, but it makes hard
yes.
to
do. But the thing is, you've got only, you can attend those tests, each test, I would say, four times.
Okay, so you take the same test four times.
Yes, in case of you fail.
Right.
And you have only six sitting. So if you divide 14 by, you have to have more than two tests per sitting.
Okay, well, okay, from the practical side, then, you need to get the books.
Yes.
And I've seen these in the U.S., you can get the books, and the cost is about the same, and it is a stack about...
And each test used to be like 80 pounds, 80 euro British pounds.
Right.
So just make the math. It's just gonna cost you. But the trick is let's.
Well, so how long did it take you to get your JAR?
Like a year.
Okay.
Because I had to manage to take a week off because I would say at the end of the previous months, the flight school asked you to come over, so you drill, review all the tests,
right,
all the
right.
questions to make sure that you understood. Then.
And do you have to?
Attend this.
And you have to attend those classes in the country
yes.
you're doing it in.
Yes, in
and,
order...
And you do that in, does it, you said it doesn't have to be the UK, you could have done that in France?
Yes, I could have done that in France, in Spain, in Italy.
Okay.
And
the US, can you do it, or no?
No, not yet. Even though you start to have some flight school, even though you start to have flight school, British flight school, for instance, going in US simply because the cost of the flight is cheaper.
Right, well, so... Basically, you need to go to Europe to get. You need to go and spend 6 months to a year in Europe to get these
yes,
licenses,
absolutely.
Or else you'll be flying back and forth. A lot.
Yeah, but the trick is.
Well, let's move on from that. I think we've got the basics
mm-hmm.
of how to get that. What to have it to get a J? What are the advantages of having a JAR license? Why did you do it?
Working in Europe.
Okay.
So because with an FAA license, you cannot work in Europe. Well,
right.
unless the company will have an registered airplane. But it's getting more and more difficult, and they try nowadays in Europe just to get rid of all November airplanes for some reason because they think that the maintenance is not done correctly. It's like there's a lot of issues with those and registered airplanes. But
okay.
the maintenance is the same. You
right.
have to change the oil, you have to change the plug, you've got to change the tires.
So in Europe, they're discouraging people with FAA licenses
from general
flying.
Aviation,
they're really
yes.
They're really looking for, even general aviation, they
yeah,
want them
aviation,
to have a JAR.
Yes. There's no way you will find an aero club with an unregistered airplane. It's
okay.
private owned.
Okay, in
airplane.
Terms of the JAR, the differences between the JAR training and the FAA license, what type of questions would they ask on an exam that might might be different from the FAA?
You might have to do any kind of mat formula from point A to point B, what will be the track. There's like more details.
Okay,
there's more details. It's expanded.
It's much more. I've heard they talk more about like celestial navigation.
Yes.
And HF radios will pop up.
Yes, you've got. We've got two tests. One is VFR communication, and the other one is IFR communication.
Okay.
And you have like you have to have a radio license.
Those might be adaptive radio. Which would be the HF.
Yes, which is the HF. You go for a specific test, and you
in the US, you used to it used to be that you had to have a radio license. That requirement they got rid of because it just wasn't practical.
You only needed, I think, if I remember that, if you go abroad, you go on somewhere else. And
between like a flight information service and a
pretty controller. Basic.
Yeah, yeah, very basic.
So not something to be nervous about.
No, I think you needed it before going solo.
Okay, I think you were going to be talking on the radio.
Yeah,
that's I always find the funny thing about radios. People make a big deal about correct radio procedures, and generally you're just talking.
Yeah,
that's what I've always seen. Okay, well, that kind of, like, I wanted to get the JAR in there because I've been interested in it and how long it would take. And I've looked it up online quite a bit just for the same reason, kind of expand
but
some options.
The main idea is to make sure that people will understand you do not convert.
Right, it's not
convert, I think it's, my English is not that good, but you've got to understand it's
getting issued a different license.
Yes.
And they're accepting some of your credit for your previous experience.
Absolutely.
That's, yeah, that may be, I've looked at the Canadian license quite a bit too, and I think they call that a conversion. I don't know how a New Zealand license.
So, if you're Australian, or possibly if you have an Australian license, you can convert. Because we're
so close.
Yeah, we're sort of
sort of the same country.
Yeah. Wouldn't go that far.
I met a Canadian woman who was flying prop dusters in Australia. She said
really?
It actually wasn't that hard to convert.
Okay.
And she had flown prop dusters in the US, but she had to go to the Australian prop dusting school.
Yeah.
But she said it was funny because it was done in a lot of 182s, or maybe it was a 185. But she said the plane was nothing like they were flying dromedaries and thrushes, which are so different from the plane they did the training in.
Yeah.
And same thing, you know, it's a single pilot airplane, all the prop dust like the Pawnees.
Yeah.
So
that's right.
When they're done, it's like, okay, here's your plane. Go.
Yeah. It's like here, for instance, if you remember when we arrived first in Nepal, they convert our license.
Right.
We were required to attend a class because air law navigation might be a little bit different here. But they took for granted our flight license and experience.
I don't think they even converted it. They gave us a temporary endorsement.
Yes, yes. Based on the fact that our American license is valid.
Yep.
So the Nepalese license will be valid. And yes, that's a temporary. Yes.
When I was at AirServe, they had a South African registered caravan. And so they'd send guys down to, I think, Cape Town, actually. And they would convert they would really get a temporary endorsement, South African endorsement, that'd be good for 6 months, then they'd have to go back and do it again. In most places in the world, if you have a license, you can fly the plane that plane is registered for your license. So that's probably what you were doing in Africa. It was a New Zealand registered plane, you had a New Zealand license.
Yeah.
So it's all fine and dandy.
Yeah.
Didn't matter. Yeah, and I think Alex and I, when we brought these planes over, we registered them as Nepalese planes in the U.S., so we had to get a letter from the Nepalese Civil Aviation Authority giving us permission to fly these Nepalese registered airplanes. All right, well, that's some of that. Let's go. Any questions the other direction? Or if I warn everybody's brain out.
Yeah. So basically, if you get this license that you have, you're opening up a big door to a lot of opportunities, all of Europe, basically, once you get your JA license.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of the companies in Africa, the European companies flying down in Africa with European registered airplanes, it would open those up as well.
Right.
It is a, from everything I've heard, it's a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
to get a JAR. Right. And most of the people I know do it are looking at the airlines.
Yes, you've got the best way right now would be to be a cadet and just get your program done and join the airline.
Yeah.
Right on, and that's what I always kept saying to students, just like, stay focused on what you want to do. Just don't buzz around. If you don't like, don't do crop dusting or flight instructor if your idea is just to join the airline. The thing is, nowadays, there's so many experienced pilots on the ground, is how much are you willing to invest
in order to
reach your goal sooner?
A lot of airlines aren't even interested in a lot of experience.
Yes.
They want someone who's going to fit into their program.
Yes. Yeah.
And so they'll hire you with 1,000 hours, but then they want to train you their way.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yes.
what I've seen. And you know, Japanese airlines, Lufthansa, they take their people from zero time and get all their commercial, they do the, you know, like the commercial and a King Air, all crew. So from the get-go, wow. they're working as a two-pilot crew, and then they put him, I'll use a 747, but they'll be the second officer in a 747. So they monitor the autopilot and the crew's legs.
New job, as the line pilot, where you basically monitor, yes, absolutely.
Yes, it sounds very exciting.
Yeah, yeah right.
I want to touch quickly on your fish spotting. There's a lot of fish spotting in Alaska too.
That was kind of a very interesting job because you on your own, I would say, first of all, that was a French company. They were using...
So you're flying for a Skymaster.
Yeah, on a Skymaster.
Cessna 337 in the Mediterranean.
Yes.
Working with the fishing boats to find the fish.
Yes.
Yeah.
First of all, that was an N-registered airplane, so that was like a very good opportunity because you've got to... It's not because you got your license, like a driver's license. You have to keep it valid.
Right.
But anyway, so I've got this job, and basically we were based in south of France. So you're friendly with those fishing boats. And the whole idea is those guys, they have 3 months to do something that other people, they would do in a year.
Amount of work.
Yes.
They have a small season. It's like, catch your fish now.
And because you make a lot of money out of this, he says, well, why don't we rent an airplane? Because an airplane can go faster.
Well, so all they're doing, to summarize it, they're using the airplane to find the, rather than the boat sailing around.
Yes, because a boat can go, like, the really fastest boat will go 18 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Rather than us, we can go 150 miles an hour,
so
and then when you're on the spot, you slow down.
So you're flying out, finding where the fish are, then you radio contact the boat. Yeah,
absolutely.
They come to this latitude and longitude.
Yes, and you help them to catch the... So you're doing like all the day long some steep turn.
Do you put in extra fuel tanks?
No, in New Zealand we do. The plan that I used...
You do fish spotting in New Zealand too?
They take just 172, but they fill the back up with fuel.
Yeah, in Alaska they use a lot of Super Cubs.
Okay.
Well, the regulation will say we won't be allowed in France to use an airplane a single engine.
Yeah.
It has to be a twin engine. And the Skymaster was very good because one engine is on the front, the other one is on the back.
Yeah.
So when you bang the plane, the observer can still see. Yeah. Other people were using the Italian airplane, what's the name of this highway airplane?
I know which one you're talking about.
The Partenavia?
Which is
very difficult to see because you've got this engine out there. And
high wing, so you still get some visibility.
And... But yeah, we were basically going all over the place, like Spain, Corsica, Libya.
Yeah.
We were allowed to work in Libya, so for a Libyan company out there. And
were you working with the same fishing boat all the
time?
Yeah,
the same fishing boat, and that was like, even though we land in Malta. You've got to go everywhere, and you don't decide. The boat will tell you, oh, tomorrow the wind is like that, the water is like...
And how do you find that job?
Connections.
Okay, just people.
Once again, we go back to the same basic. It is no longer, it doesn't matter. what you know, it's who you know.
Yeah.
It has to fit somewhere. So being online, I can spend days, hours, just to send some resume. I won't get a job in Africa. People nowadays are getting polite. Say, oh, we...
Right, so it's back to the personal connection.
You've got to
I
be
didn't
out
realize
there.
It was so common still.
In the Mediterranean, I didn't either. That's why I know Alaska, there's a lot of it. Sounds like New Zealand. I didn't realize it was widespread around the world.
Yeah, and neither
I thought
did
it
I.
was Alaska specific.
For the fishing?
The fish spotting, yeah.
Oh, they are all year round in... Eastern Africa and Western Africa around Dakar, because the tuna goes inside the Mediterranean Sea
looking for tuna primarily.
Yes, and after that, when they get out from the Gibraltar Detroit, and that's but other than that, they are all year round in the west coast of Africa.
Okay.
So you might find some people out there all year round flying like this. Otherwise, you can go to. There's plenty of companies. Some people, they will make some survey about where all the fishes are, and still looking for the name of those guys.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So those are usually, it's just the fishing boat and one airplane. It's not like you're working for a company so much. And it's not, there aren't companies that do fish spotting. You can't go apply for a job at a company, that's what they do. It's a, like they contract for the flight school or an aero club.
Yeah. I think that's what it is in New Zealand. I've never done it, but... I know one plane will talk to all of these boats.
Yeah. In Alaska, it's very competitive because each boat will have their own plane. And I just got into Alaska and I was flying through Bristol Bay on the coast. The weather wasn't terrible, but it wasn't great. It's probably like 800 over, so I'm at about 500. And I'm watching all these fishing boats and I'm thinking, oh, this is cool. I'm in Alaska, fishing boats. And then I looked up and there were all these Super Cubs diving out of the way. Because I'm flying right through the wall.
I
know they were thinking, ass wall. Yeah.
That's where the problem is. Like, you're not the only one in the sky. You've got to pay attention to where you're doing. We were dealing with...
And your spotter's looking at the water.
Yeah, Italian people, Spanish people. And the guy, he doesn't care. It's like, just don't move from here. Say, well, sir, I cannot do so. They're like, I've got to look in, look out, monitor everything.
What would you say the dangers with fish spotting are?
Look outside because you're not the only one, and you fly very low. I was like sometimes 500 feet above the water. Yes, you're 60 degrees bank angle.
Right.
The whole idea is to bring the
spot down
to spot, and you've got to to learn and
In Alaska, we call them moose stalls. Because people would be down looking at moose at usually 50 feet, and they're crank the turn really hard. Yeah, cool moose. And next thing you know, you stall them. Those are pretty common. And fish spotting, I think that sounds like that's a similar hazard. So you have to pay attention to the feel of the plane and the airspeed at the same time.
The only bad thing is like it's a seasonal work. So you've got to find something else. The nine months remaining for the year.
I mean, a lot of interesting jobs are seasonal. I mean, even this one for me is only a few months long, unfortunately. All right, well, anything else
to do with that?
Nope. How do we work in Alaska?
Boy, I mean, the biggest problem for foreign pilots is getting that work permit. You need to convert or get your license,
but
depending on how you do it.
To get the work permit, do you need a job first?
Hey, that's, I don't know.
Okay.
My guess is that you can probably get a work permit, but it's probably complicated.
Yeah, I imagine.
And it would be hard to get a job without the work permit. So it's kind of a catch-22. If you found a company that really wanted you, they might sponsor you, like Daniel was saying. But there's so many American pilots right now that it would be difficult. But, you know, I see them. I see non-American pilots flying in the U.S. Not frequently, but often enough that there've got to be ways to do it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go online and try to find some of this stuff when I get back to the States, or I'll have Mike look into it because he's really good at that stuff.
Yeah.
And I'll try to get you an email.
For the, well, actually, what was your job primarily when you were flying there?
I did a bunch of jobs in Alaska. Probably the primary job was air taxi, which is exactly what it sounds like. You're an airborne taxi cab. And that's it's just what we're doing in Nepal. they're flying passengers and supplies. The only way food gets to the villages in Alaska is by air. And that food is flown in via bypass mail system, where the companies are paid really well to fly this food per pound. And that actually subsidizes the passenger travel.
Okay.
So the airfares, which normally might be a couple hundred dollars, are down to, you know, $80.
And this was flying?
This is flying everything. I flew 172s, 207s, a lot of caravan time, a lot of 207 time, 402s.
So it depends on the load, kind of.
It does depend on the load, and it's, you know, it's most fun for me if you're checked out in multiple airplanes, because then you do one flight in the caravan, then you jump in the 406s on the plane. We'd go back and forth between them a lot. That's getting less prevalent, I think, from pressure from the FAA, and also just the impracticality of having someone do multiple check rides. You're starting to see more standardization of airplanes, a lot of caravans, and I think you're seeing more people get checked out in one plane and staying with that plane. There are exceptions, obviously.
It sort of sounds like, what's your ratio of landing at a, you know, like this, a sealed couple thousand feet long, as opposed to your off-airport or
rough
strip?
Rough strips. It depends where you're flying. And all of the rough strips are starting to get improved. If your Bethel's probably one of the more difficult places to fly out of. It's flat, so no hills to hit, but the runways are a lot worse. Again, they've improved some of the worst runways. Yeah. Like Eek used to be a bad one. Kotlik up by St. Mary's was bad. But you're usually landing on one paved strip, which is the main, would be Bethel.
Yeah.
So you might go out, do four or five stops on dirt strips, and then or mud, and break up in springtime, which is really April, May. You can have, you know, 6 inches of mud. And
wow.
Sometimes you just shut the airports down because you tear the props up, and you may not get off the ground.
What do you mean when you say a bad strip? Like rocks or
short, narrow. Like our strips here are all really wide.
Yeah.
Like I remember the guys mentioned Simico, and they're like, "Oh, it's really narrow. Half of it's getting paved now." When I looked, I was like, "Man, it's still wider than a lot of these Alaskan strips."
Okay.
You know, Eek was probably, you had probably 5 or 6 feet on either side of a 207, so a caravan was even tighter. But Eek's now a new runway, so it's really like 4,000. That's huge. So they are changing that quite a bit. The company I flew the fuel there, we were flying larger airplanes, DC-6s and 46s, into pretty short strips as well, and that every landing was kind of like landing up here, where it's sort of a maximum performance, you need to get it stopped, and then your big runway would be coming back. That's where you'd put the bulk fuel on, and it's usually a paved strip. In terms of true off airport, there is the Hunters. We usually do real off airport, and often with a guide company. That's actually not a bad place to start if you're looking for work, because often it's one plane, one pilot, and if you know the owner of the company, you can sort of get in easily.
Yeah.
They'd be willing to work with you. But those people, they're landing on ridgetops, and they might know that it's a good ridgetop. They know it's a landing area, and they're like, "Oh, I've landed here before." But,
okay.
You know, they land there 10 times a year, and you'll often do a low pass, check out the condition. The other challenging thing about the Alaskan strips, they get covered in ice in the winter. So you're not landing on dirt, gravel, you're landing on ice. When it's cold out, the ice is really sticky, so you can actually break, and it's fine.
Okay.
When it warms up and you get a thin layer of water on top of the ice, there's no breaking.
Okay.
And then you take a 3,000-foot strip, and suddenly it's a maximum performance strip for a caravan. You know, you need a touchdown on the end, because you're just going to be sliding for X amount of time.
Wow.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
But the runways, you know, everybody always says that, you know, back in the old days, everything was worse. I'm sure in the 70s and 80s, things were even rougher. But I've definitely seen it since 95 when I started flying there. The runways are improving every year. Yeah, that started in sort of the early 2000s. They really started.
Okay.
But this air taxi, they're not so much the Alf Airport flying?
No, it's like a regional airline in small planes.
Okay.
But you're not IFR point to point. It's you might depart IFR from your main hub. Usually you file to a fix, like 40 DME out. After that, there's no longer any airways or approaches to the airports. So 40 miles out, it's magically VFR. And go find your airport. And all of this is changing. You're seeing more GPS approaches popping up.
Okay.
And the next 10 years are going to be big. Things are going to change a lot. And you're going to see more people filing IFR to the small airports. And that's going to really be a hassle. Because you'll have people holding, you know, you'll double the time it takes to get the job done.
Yeah.
So, I don't, you heard me say it on the ramp. Alaska is one of the freest places I've ever flown. In terms of, you get an airplane, people say, go do the job.
Yeah.
In New Zealand might be similar.
Yeah. Some areas you don't speak often. So I'm guessing that's the other thing. You're just talking to yourselves when you're out there. You don't have people waiting in the middle of nowhere for you, sort of telling you what's what and what it looks like.
No, you'll talk to the guy who landed before you. Hey, what's it like? And, you know, a common phrase is, it was okay, but maybe not common, but a phrase I would use if maybe it wasn't strictly legal or it was really bad, you might say, well, you know, I got in and out, but I wouldn't go back again.
Yeah, okay.
And that's giving the guy, hey, listen, it's doable, but it might be more exciting than you want to deal with.
Yeah, sure.
And there's a lot of communication with the other pilots. The IFR traffic often throws a wrench in there because they won't be talking on the CTAF, on the common frequency. And so they just show up on an approach out of nowhere, and everybody else is all coordinated and talking to each other. Suddenly, here comes this plane talking to center. And we can often get Anchorage center way out in Boonies. But they can't, you don't have radar, you know, they're just talking to you.
Yeah.
But you don't often talk to people. If you have a flight plan filed and you talk to your agents on the ground to find out what your next load is, you're not talking to them as a safety precaution so much, although it doubles as that. If you tell them, hey Dan, I'll be in White Mountain in 10 minutes, and 20 minutes go by, he's going to say, hey, where are you? I'm waiting. Hold.
So you don't actually know, or sometimes you'll go somewhere not knowing where you're going next, so they might have a load for...
Well, you usually have an idea,
because
the main mail will come out of the hub. And so let's say I'm based in Nome, I get, you know, 2,000 pounds and 3 passengers, and I'm supposed to go White Mountain, Gullibin, Elam, Koyuk, and back to Nome. And what'll happen, you'll get to White Mountain, or partway to White Mountain, and they'll say, we just picked up an Elam to Gullibin.
Okay.
So like, okay, well, my load's not going to work out to go Elam and backwards. So I'm going to go to White Mountain, drop the mail. Then I'll go to Elam, pick up the Inner Village passenger, and go back to Gullibin. So your plan changes. And the flight plan you file to the FAA obviously is no longer pertinent.
Yeah.
But you're always communicating with someone in the practical side of this is what I need to accomplish in this flight. A lot of airports are, you know, 5 minutes apart. So you go Nome, White Mountain, that's about 25 minutes. Gullibin's 7 minutes away. Elam's another 7 to 10. You know, you get these little short hops.
And they're mostly flat. Do they find a flat spot, or they park on a hill, make a strip there where it's easier?
They're usually pretty flat. Yeah, we don't like it. Alaska's either flat or hilly. I mean, it's either there's plenty of flat space where you can put a runway, or it's the big mountains. Southeast would be an exception, and Southeast has a lot of float flying. You can land on the water and taxi up to the docks. And the big mountain stuff is often flying the skis, flying the climbers in, and that's a whole separate kind of genre of Alaskan flying. Okay. And then the hunters, they'll land on ridgetops, but usually not on strips. So our airports are—they're more like Joomla.
Okay.
In that they're without the valleys.
Yeah.
You know, it's a flat area.
All right.
And they're built to last
some of the strips here, they seem to choose interesting spots for them.
Or Rara, like they're still working on it.
Yeah.
Like, come on, guys. But I hear it used to be better. You've made it worse.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. Well, you'll make a runway worse.
Yeah. They picked the center line of the runway pointing towards a big hillside, which was their first mistake.
And they've manufactured, I've seen those big, they wire those rocks off to hold the surface of the runway in.
Yeah.
They pile the dirt in there and the gravel. And you'd think if they could do that, they could either blast the rocks that are away. So a lot of these runways in Nepal, you've got a runway, and then right off the approach end, you'll have a rock sticking out, so you can't make a straight in. That's what we're talking about. Now, in Alaska, you can generally get a straight in. It's different challenges than here. Here, these runways are more like Rara in particular. It's absolutely 100% for a caravan every time. And every landing, you need to get it right. Alaska, it'll vary. You know, if it's icy, you have to pay attention. You get a lot of crosswinds. 40, 50 knots may not be common, but it's not uncommon.
Okay.
Caravan, I hold it about 40, but it doesn't taxi well. And the weather's atrocious in Alaska. Here, you really can't fly when it's that bad because there are mountains to hit.
Mm.
You know, in Western Alaska, you go down to 20 feet and there's not much to hit.
Yeah.
But a lot of people try that and hit things anyway, so.
So then if I was to go to Alaska with the hope of getting a job, the best thing is, like in New Zealand, just
walk the ramp.
Okay.
Yeah, the best thing is if you know someone.
Yeah.
And you get an introduction.
But if you wanted to more specifically do, say, the... well, I guess most new pilots can't go straight into the off-airport stuff, but...
You'd be surprised.
Okay.
I know I've got an interview with Paul Roderick on the website talking to him, and I actually knew this before I talked to him, that he hires a lot of people without a lot of experience because he can teach them to fly how he wants to fly them. And as he said, you take a guy with a lot of time, especially if they're flying for the airlines, and he may not be able to teach them.
Yeah.
They're very set on this. This is how I fly the airplane.
And that was the same with the first company.
And do it first before you do something. Yeah. But you should be interested. It's just you like Alaska because of the temperature or the adventure. You should try as well as Hawaii or the Guam Island. Guam Island might be its American territory, so
yeah.
Might be different, closer to your place anyway.
Yeah, there's an attraction to Alaska, certainly for me, and it sounds like you kind of see that Alaska's it's a great place to fly. There's a lot of aviation, and there's a lot of aviation. It's worth going to Anchorage once and just walking around Lake Hood and looking at all the planes.
Yeah, yeah.
And get a float rating. Getting a seasonal job first might be easier.
So, by that, do you mean as a loader?
Oh, no,
is
thinking
that how
more...
it starts?
Yeah, that's a great way to do it. I mean, you've got a fair amount of time, so it's hard to go back to loading.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's...
I'd get a bit itchy after a while.
Yeah, that's a good way into it. I was looking at a company recently because I'd like to get into floats. And I was saying I'd fly their land planes, and then when they need a float guy, they said, like, well, shit, well, you don't have the float experience we want, but we need someone to fly this plane.
Yeah.
So go to here, and next thing you know, you're a float pilot. A trial by fire.
Yeah.
But I would, you know, if you have some time off, I would go walk the ramp in Anchorage and start talking to people, try to get some introductions, go to the smaller airlines, and the most people aren't going to act very interested. They're going to kind of be like, yeah, it's
used to that, though.
Yeah, like, yeah, no, it's your pilot.
Yeah.
And then try to stay in touch with people who are at the airlines. If you, you know, find someone, go out and have a beer with some guys. And,
yeah.
That's a real good way. Your main sticking point is going to be that the work permit and the FAA license.
Yeah, I think realistically it's going to be more of a headache than anything else, but
it might be.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to be discouraging, but I
no. Well, I've I've wanted to do this since I was about 10, was when I first saw a show on National Geographic.
Oh, on Alaska?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, some guy landing in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
On nothing.
Well, that's more of the hunting again. So much stuff's kind of established now that even a lot of the hunting is like, oh, we go to this ridge top. And you are landing on nothing, but it's still, it's been done before. And once it's been done once or twice, it's like, you know, the plane's going to do it. And then that little bit of the judgment of, is this going to work? Not that it's not still challenging.
Yeah, sure.
And there's definitely, I mean, it still exists. I know Roderick's flown people into places on glaciers for climbing that, well, that he said he wouldn't go back to. And that's with the Garrett-powered Otter, which
is
a lot of horsepower.
Yeah.
And so he's still experimenting and finding places. It's still out there, and the float flying is always challenging because your surface changes.
So sure.
Even if you're going back to the same lake, and the loads are, Alaska's challenging because the loads, you tend to fly heavier loads than most places I've worked. I won't say more than that. But you are sea level, and it's usually chilly.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely, if you wanted to come up, you should come visit and look around. And
yeah, I certainly do plan on it.
Cool.
And that's something that I am going to do.
Yeah. Like I said, I'll get your email. And
yeah, sure.
Yeah, Alaska's great. Anything else?
My brain's fried.
Yeah, it's warming up. We got to go see if we got flights going today. Everyone's been on strike in the villages, so we haven't been... So we've had an opportunity to sit down and chat, which has been great.
Yeah,
cool.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com for more stuff like it.